Let's get started. A bunch of things to be announced. Okay, so I returned exam one. I corrected both versions, and then there is also the solutions, the correct solutions that I'm giving each of you a hard copy. We'll say a few more things about the exam one, but. Before that, project 2 is due on Wednesday. How are things going for most people? Happiness, unhappiness, what? it's your time. I mean, you basically, whatever time you spend would have to be coming out of the overall semester, yes. Does that work? Okay. So we'll just the class. It will be due on next Monday then. Okay. Again, as I said, the parts have to basically. I mean, you have to complete part two so that you can do a lot more interesting things in part three. But part three, more or less, there's a lot more options as to what you might spend your time on. So you do have to complete part two. I mean, the part three that is. So you do. I do want you to complete part two. And in the worst case, that those of you who don't actually complete part two even by Monday, that's the nominal deadline, but I would still require that all of you are done with part one and two by the time the semester is over. So because there will be an entire project, you would have to demo the project to the TA. The whole thing is working. Okay, so you must have to do that by the end of the semester. So these are partly to put some structure and partly to make sure that there are deadlines during the semester rather than just all at the end. Homework 3. I put up homework 3. I put actually 4 questions right there, all of them at the same time. This is the NBC classifier. This has collaborative filtering and XML. This has XQuery interfaces. So by end of today, you should be able to do pretty much all of those things. Just one point, which is this one. It's a PDF file, and I edited it. Okay, so this one actually has given in the collaborative filtering. It was an exam question from a previous time, and we actually gave you the Pearson correlation coefficient there, but I want you to recompute them and verify that they are correct. So that's part of the question now. So just don't, start with them. Recompute and make sure that the correlation coefficients are right. Okay, so that will make you actually at least try that formula. So that's what I put there. Okay. Okay. That's homework 3. I'm going to close it fairly soon, and then it'll be due probably in like around 10th of November. So as usual, I close it and it'll give you 1 week time. Okay. So we're already done with the NBC the text classification and the collaborative and content based filtering. So those were previously done. XML we've been discussing, so you have pretty much everything that you need to do that. Okay. One other thing is that look at the lecture notes. In the bottom, I put together there an approximate schedule So there's so many classes still left. I suddenly realized that I almost have a whole course to teach and I run out of ideas, but I hope I'll find more things to teach you. But we have 13 full classes left. These are some of the things that I'm planning to do. This is a rough outline of what are the various topics we're going to look at. Take a look at that. We may have time over and beyond that, and I also am happy to adjust that time. So if there are specific topics that you would like to see covered, send me an email, okay, and I can discuss about them, okay. So today we would actually be doing XQuery a little bit, and then also look at some of the semantic web standards, RDF, RDF schema, mostly to kind of give you an idea as to where they come in. And time permitting, talk about how ontologies are made, and then we talk about fun stuff like folk taxonomies, which probably some of you are at least familiar with. And that's one case where the web has gone ahead of the researchers who are trying to catch up with what it is, what do folk taxonomies mean. So we'll talk a little bit about those things. Either today or next class, based on when we complete our discussion. And then after that, the next big topic I'm going to talk about is information extraction. There's at least one lecture on it where information extraction essentially is, if you're given text-oriented web pages, can you somehow capture structure out of it? Especially I mentioned earlier that some of this text may have been generated by databases. And so this pseudo-English, and so you just invert the pseudo-English and get the database tuples back. But there's also more ambitious ideas of trying to just pick up facts from preformed text. So sort of doing an NLP, a little more NLP than what we're doing. Right now we're basically doing nothing. And do a little bit more NLP, you may be able to pick up some of the inherent facts in a particular web page. So we'll talk about some of those issues, then data integration and a bunch of things regarding data integration, and this actually, the folk taxonomy stuff actually comes up earlier itself today. Okay, so as I said, if there are topics that you could think of that we should talk about, send me an email and we should be able to put them together. I realize that we actually are quite ahead of time in terms of things that I wanted to do. Okay. So those are the statistics on the exam itself. Does anybody know this quote? See, we at least have some people who figure out these things. Something close. Anna Karenina. This is the very first sentence of Anna Karenina in English translation. Anybody else needs this? It's considered one of the best opening sentences of any novel. And the reason I put it there is I gave you solutions, but really the fun part of grading is that there's one single correct answer and many, many neat ways of doing incorrect answers, which gives me ideas for next year's exam, if I remember. But I think, in fact, it's useful to discuss some of them. I can't write all the incorrect ways, answers that people have done, but some of them are useful to talk about. So you have your solutions in front of you. Let's just look at a couple of them. So in question one, these are things that are probably obvious to many people, except for a couple of people who made the mistake, but we may as well just talk about it aloud. When we are normalizing TF values, term frequency values, you just do it with respect to a single document. Okay, so the given a document, you take the frequency of your term divided by the maximum of the frequency of any term in that document, not in the entire corpus, but just in that document. So TF is actually a local measure. IDF is a global measure. You can get all the TF parts just by looking at that document. You don't have to look at any other document. Some people at least have normalized TF with respect to the entire corpus. Okay, so that's something that is an interesting mistake. I wouldn't have thought about it, but that's a mistake anyway. in the relevance feedback thing, the beta and the gamma factors have a denominator, which is a cardinality of DN, which is the number. It's a cardinality, it's a number of documents that are found to be relevant, and number of documents that are found to be relevant, not the magnitude of any single document. And in the exam question, actually, there was only a single document, and so several people actually put the magnitude of that document rather than the cardinality. Okay, so that's something that came up a couple of times. In LSI question, DFTF. So actually, it's an interesting thing. You could either do it to compare the documents. You can either do DF times FF, of course, and then just take the first two columns. Or you could also do DT times TF. You should be able to prove that they're exactly one and the same. Okay? Basically, what you're doing is, if you multiply this, so you remember that DT is DF times FF times TF. So if you multiply it by, if you multiply it by TF, and on both sides on TF, that becomes an identity matrix, because TF is an orthonormal matrix. Okay, so in essence, DF times FF is the same as DT times TF. Either one would work, whichever you feel like. It's not an error, but I think at least one person has done it that way, and that's a nice way to do it too. In the case of question three, authorities hubs, the normal expectation is that in each iteration, you know, one of them, the authorities, would depend on the hubs or vice versa. So in fact, the way we discussed it is, you set the authorities, and in that same iteration, the hubs would take the current authorities, not the previous authorities, into account. Okay? So that's something that, and then you do have to normalize it. And for some weird reason, a lot of people have trouble squaring numbers and adding them. You know, the square root of 14, I saw square root of 12, square root of 13. With the same numbers, people would come up with different additions, even at home for some reason. And one of the interesting things, of course, is the bias that a wrong answer in the exam causes you to repeat it again at home. Okay? So those of you who actually did it twice sometimes did the same thing twice. The mistakes also. Let's see, what else? In the case of page rank, one of the most interesting things is that the transition matrix has to be a stochastic matrix. So each column has to add up to one. So you start with the adjacency matrix, you take the transpose of it, and then normalize each column. And if you don't normalize it, then what you get essentially would have they're no longer probabilities. You know, many, many people actually wound up having a page rank matrix which is has in the first column two entries would be 0.866. So you add them all up, that's way too much probability mass. Okay, and then when in the case of the second part where you have c equal to zero, all that means when c is equal to zero, what that means essentially is that you're just doing random surfing. Okay. And so since the probability of going from any page to any other page is the same, you know, you would actually, the final page rank would also be the same for all pages. Now, what would it be? It has to add up to 1. So it's not 1 by root 3, 1 by root 3, 1 by root 3. Because if you add 3 1 by root 3, so you'll get 3 by root 3, which is root 3, which is greater than 1. So you don't want it that way. Several people had trouble figuring out that the number of clusters that for which the dissimilarity would be lowest would be k equal to 4, which is surprising because we went through it several times in the class. But even those people who did have k equal to 4, actually some of them wound up saying the dissimilarity itself would be 4, you know, dissimilarity has to be zero because you're computing the dissimilarity, not the similarity. Okay. Hierarchical agglomerative clustering is fine. And then that gets us to the last part. There are a large number of different answers for number one. We talked about several of them, things like clustering, et cetera, and why they are not as reasonable as something as simple as just relevance feedback. Okay. For the second one, the computation advantage, you have to basically point out that without this, without the inverted indices, you will wind up looking at all the documents. That's where you die. Okay. Now, in 3B, there was an interesting question, which is somebody actually pointed this out, that many people actually wound up answering 3B qualitatively rather than with respect to 3A. Okay, I don't know why. I mean, that's, again, and once they did it in the exam, they also did the same thing at home. You know, you don't re-look at the question. You know, it's a, you know, it sticks in your head. So I actually meant it to be with respect to the part A. That's why I called part B. Somebody basically pointed out that the best way to have the highest precision is to stop with the first document returned. You know, best way to get the highest precision is to stop at the first document returned. That's obviously not true. Okay, you just have to realize that. Yes.
Obviously not true in general, obviously not true for this problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's not true for this problem, and so it's not true in general. But I mean, if you want to remember an obvious case, so suppose I have a search engine which does junk until the 100th place. So if you stop, and the first good result it gives is at the 100th place. So if you stop right there, your precision will be 1 over 100. But then from 100 to 150, it gives only good results, only relevant results. So if you stop at 150, then your precision is 50 over 150, which is one-third, as against 1 over 150, okay? Yeah, the magnetic word sets are fine. Your friend is making a search engine analysis simple. That's also, we discussed that. Most people got it fine. For the k-means, even people who got it right, I mean, who I gave full points, I don't really think they understood exactly what. But part of it is because we didn't discuss it in that length in the class. It's true that the difference between you and your friend has to be something to do with the distance measure. But it doesn't have to be that you're using Euclidean and they're using Jaccard. Okay? It could be much more than that. Distance measures don't have to be the simple kinds of distance measures that we looked at where all axes are given the same weight. Okay, I could give much higher weight to certain axes, certain dimensions than other dimensions. Okay, there are whole family of distances called Mahalanobis distances where what you wind up doing is you essentially take the x1 minus x1 dash square plus y1 minus y1 dash square, the usual thing that we do, except you do lambda 1 square times this plus lambda 2 square times this plus lambda 3 square times this, where lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3 can be different numbers. That winds up giving different weights to different directions. Now this is just the beginning. You can actually have, you know, distance defined in any which way you want. Okay, so it's true that it's because the distance measures are different, but you know, distance doesn't have to be anything to do with Euclidean and Jaccard. And in fact, if in fact your friend and you were using Euclidean and Jaccard, most likely you would have found the same k-means clustering. In most cases, you know, you're going to get very similar answers. If you remember, the TA did some analysis on comparing normalized Jaccard versus vector space, and he found basically there's very, very little difference between them. Okay, and then the most disappointing question is number 7. Very few people. I was hoping that this would be the question where everybody will tell me some neat factoid that they read that they didn't say here. I mean, it's possible that I'm so expansive that I'm touching everything in the world, and so there's nothing left that you could figure it out yourself. But I was still hoping that there is something left in the papers that you could pick up. But most people either repeated what I told them before, mostly, in fact. Okay. There's only one guy who did it well, Garrett. Why don't you read your answer? That's the only one in home. This is both at in class and at home. I didn't find anything interesting. It's not that, it's not a value judgment. I was hoping that we will collectively find some interesting factoids. Okay, this was my doing the semester review a little earlier on, so that we'll get more factoids. But I didn't get anything new, except the ones that he wrote in the at home version. I know that neither of them I mentioned in the class. So that's the existence proof that it must have been, somebody must have actually read the papers. I'm sure several of you probably read the papers, but you thought, I would like to hear what I said more than what the paper said. But I really would like to hear, I mean, I was hoping that this will be a way you would have picked up things. Expansive as this class might be, we're only touching pieces here and pieces there. So there's a lot more out there. Okay? So that's basically the only things that we have. Here, there's a humongous amount of statistics there, including this is the at home, this is the in-class. In the in-class, this is the overall average. This is just for the grads alone. This is just for the undergrads alone. So that if you are interested in computing, comparing yourself to your equivalence class, okay? Okay. Any questions? Okay. So what I plan to do today is to talk about querying of XML. I sent a bunch of mails asking you guys to look at XQuery a little bit before coming, because I'm not planning to actually do XQuery case by case in front of you. There are 10,000 use cases for XQuery, and each of them is interesting if you are interested in knowing exactly all queries that can be written in XQuery. I would do some of the important issues, some of the things that I think are interesting about XQuery, and then I put in a homework question, which is really the first time I taught this course. That was the first or second time I taught this course. It was actually a project. It just became a homework now. Basically, what you do is you write a bunch of simple XML queries, XQuery queries, on the same bibliography data that several of them have. Okay. So we were talking about this last time, that there is you are interested in querying XML, and there are bunches of standards, and XQuery seems to be the current favorite, which actually W3C sort of endorsed. So that, by the way, is the this is actually, there are several XQuery processors that are available public domain, so that you can write a couple of XQuery queries and see if it if you got the hang of them. Okay. The homework actually asks you to use this, and because it works right now. Okay. Every year, one of the ones which is working no longer works. The Microsoft one used to work before they pulled it. So this one works, and in fact, you can either write your own query, or you can pick one of the queries that's present in the humongous XQuery use case document. Okay. So this is, this you'll be using this in homework 4. Okay, so XQuery, I'm going to just repeat a couple of things. Ask me questions if you have more interesting questions, and if I have any answers, I'll let you know. So XQuery queries are sort of like SQL queries. You have flower expressions, F for, let, where, return. Okay, so the where is sort of same as SQL where, and then you are talking about for the bindings that are given here, where new variables are being described here. And then the return is interesting. It's just talking about what results you return. Okay. Now, the queries themselves work on paths, and then there's a whole entire grammar for syntax for path expressions on XML documents. The thing to realize is ultimately an XML document is a rooted tree. And so you are essentially asking for certain patterns to be satisfied by different branches in the tree. Okay? So you give the constraints ultimately are the branches, the constraints that need to be satisfied with the various branches. Okay. Now comparing to SQL, which I hope you know, XQuery does support everything that SQL supports. Okay. Of course with different syntax. There are default queries which are like in the XQuery use case, I think it's called the DB use case or something, forget. But if you look at the list of use cases for the XQuery, there's one set of them which are basically trying to show that we can do everything that databases can do, I mean that SQL can do. Okay, on top of SQL, the interesting extensions that XQuery has are things like construction. First of all, it's not in databases, in SQL, all you can do is return tuples, that's all. You know, there's only one syntax, tuples in, tuples out. Okay, now here, XML in, XML out. Now XML has a lot more interesting nested structure and all that stuff. Okay, so you can actually construct a new XML file in returning a query. Okay, so you can set up new tags as part of the query specification. For example, if I have a bunch of books in a bibliography XML database, then I just don't like the word author, but I want to say writer, I can just reconstruct this whole thing with one single query, which says, wherever there is author, put writer, and put the rest of it together. Okay, now when you can do this, the construction part of it really is, the construction part of it is really very similar to the style sheet, the XSL style sheet, because if you can construct arbitrary XML expressions, then you can also construct HTML expressions from XML input. So wherever there's a writer, I might want to say bold, and wherever there's a price, I might want to say italics. And that would be an HTML output. And then that can then be thrown to your rendering engine in Internet Explorer or something, and then it'll show it to you. Nice. Okay. So that construction is an interesting aspect, which is something that you don't see obviously in SQL. Path expressions, navigating the XML tree is a big deal because you actually have a tree structure, so you can say, give me all the paths which have the following structure. So the constraints now are not just selection constraints, but they are selection on the path. Okay, that's another interesting issue. XML supports simple text queries. There is a use case called text use case. You should look at them in case you haven't looked at them to see what sorts of text queries, such as contains. It can, for example, look at, give me the thing which contains the following string. Okay. So those are actually the main things, and this is actually another interesting thing. In XML, the tags as well as the data are directly available to the query processor, right? In a database query processor, in an SQL, for example, you just get the tuples. So one of the nice things is it's kind of an interesting issue, which is that there is no differentiation between data and metadata. Okay, so in fact, when you are reconstructing, you're changing the column names, in essence. Okay, if you change that tags, you're changing the column names. So you can actually make queries which look at such things as, when there is no writer field, do the following. Okay, these are kind of more naturally available in XQuery. Okay, so those are some of the issues in which XQuery is different from SQL. I'll just do two queries. There are lots and lots of examples we can do, but I'm hoping that A, you would spend time looking at all the other examples, and I'm forcing you to do it with the homework. And these two are just give you some idea of the fact that we construct and we also support normal database queries. So this one, for example, is the XQuery for saying, for all books after 1991, return with the year changed from a tag to an attribute. Okay? Now, notice that there is no equivalent query in SQL for this. Okay, you actually have tags in front of you and you're changing tags to attributes. As far as SQL is concerned, I don't even know how to express it. It's like saying Eskimos have 33 different words for ice. And when they use most of them, you know, people in Arizona think, what are you talking about? You know, we have no words for ice. Okay, so there is extra expressiveness here because of the language that we're using here. So this is fairly obvious, I think, for the element B in the, that's basically the bibliography, that's the database. You know, you can actually refer to it by an URL, almost, okay? Where the publisher of the element B is Edison Wesley, and the attribute year is greater than 1991. Okay, because I wanted books after 1991. And this is at fine, presumably, is to differentiate between just the sub-element and the attribute. Okay. Now comes the fun part, which is the return part, where you construct a new XML template, which will then be filled up for each tuple that you're returning. Okay, so you're saying return book, you start as book, year, is basically now the year has become the attribute this time, year equal to, that basically right after book you have the attribute value right there, and then the title is there, and the book element ends. Okay, and then the answer for such a query would be something like that. Of course, the more answers will be there if you have more books. Okay, here is another one which is actually kind of interesting because it also does joins. When you do joins, for example, you are beyond XSL. Okay, whatever we did previously is almost doable with just XSL style sheets being overloaded as a query language, as again as just a rendering language. Okay, but when you're doing things like joining, you're talking about more interesting database-oriented operations. So here, basically, this query is saying, give me all the books that cost me more at Amazon than at FatBrain, which are two different book databases. Okay, and it also has at least one example of let, where you're defining new variables that you're going to use in part of the query. Okay. Let me see if I can. This one essentially, if you go play with this later on, it has all the numbered use cases from the XQuery document. Okay, and so you can pick one of them. Let's see. So that there is XMP use cases, the tree use cases, the sequence use cases. The R, by the way, are the system R, I think. The R is supposed to be the database size type query. So the system R use cases, system R is the old, the one of the first database engines. Then SGML use cases, the string use cases, and I forget what NS is. And so those are all the use cases from the XQuery document. And so you can actually, for want of anything better to do, you can pick them and it will give you the query. You can change it if you want, and then submit it, and it'll run it on the database that it already has. And in the homework question 4, I'm essentially asking you to do a bunch of such queries. If I can get you there. Okay, so a bunch of queries, you know, do a join query. A join query and a selection projection query at least. That's all I guess. No, 3 and 4. Text search query and a reformatting query. Okay. That extra credit might actually go away and it will become required. I think, you know, you guys are smart enough. You might as well do all 4. Okay. That's all I'm going to say about XQuery, the syntax. Now, syntax is a boring thing to discuss in a class. You just have to read syntax. Okay. Now, a couple more things. Are there any additional questions? I'm sure there are like a million extra questions as to what are those other use cases, but beyond that, are there any other questions that I can answer? Okay. So a couple of points that I want to make is the connection between the people. I think I mentioned this when we started talking about XML, that the set of people that were like the most excited about XML are the database folks. Okay, and as I said, if you look at an IR, SIGIR, which is the top conference in IR, information retrieval, they barely have, you know, XML anywhere in their papers, you know, in the titles of the paper. But you pick SIGMOD or VLDB, they're like half of them are something to do with XML. XQuery, XPath, X something, etc. So what's this frenzy about XML in database community? So basically, here is my take on it. So one interesting idea is that convert all databases from relational to XML. Okay. The assumption is that somehow, of course, there's a bigger assumption, which is somehow entire web would be written in XML, okay, where everybody agrees on the tags. That is not really true, and in fact, we will go towards that when we talk about some of these things like RDF and RDFS, which are some of the newer standards. But one minimal thing is that convert all the databases from relational to XML. So database people will stop doing relational databases and start supporting XML databases. So all data would be stored in XML format, and all the query processing would be done native on native XML data. Okay, that's one idea. The other idea, so that's basically sort of this. The other idea is just be relational database guy, because there are way too many relational databases out there. Act as if for outsiders you can speak XML. So don't change yourself, just support XML queries. Okay, all you need to do is put a front end for every relational database out there, which, you know, here is the SQL front end, here is the XQuery front end. And you take XQuery queries here and you run it on the same underlying data. Okay, now this, so if you're doing this part, then essentially you're talking about what are the issues in pretending to be an XML guy on the web. If you are really a RDBMS guy and you want to pretend and support XML queries on it, what do you need to do? Okay, there are issues of translation. So not every question, so if I, for example, I could change myself into a quote-unquote Midwestern American or act like an American while I am still brought up in India. Okay, I'll let you guess what I'm doing, but there are different issues in both of them. Okay, and there are questions that might be supported in XQuery that may not even have a translation into SQL. For example. So then your facade of a translation fails down. So if you say something that every kid who goes to an American elementary school would know, and you make a, you know, cultural remark on that, and I give you, you know, a completely bewildered expression, then you realize that, yeah, it's just a facade. It's just a American front end to something else, okay? Unless I quickly find a way of translating all of that to something that I can understand, okay? So there is an entire area which of database research which does this side, which is supporting RDBMS queries, I mean, XML queries and RDBMS. The other, of course, is a bunch of database people who say, hey, look, you know, now that XML has come along, we'll forget about relational data. These are the same people who forgot about relational data when object-oriented database came along and then came back to relational. And then they again forgot about relational databases when deductive databases came along and they again went back to relational databases. They again forgot about relational databases when object relational databases came along. They again went to relational databases. And now they got XML. They say, hey, let's forget about relational databases once and for all. Let's just do XML directly. Okay. Now, given the way database community works, you know that these guys are fighting an uphill battle. Because IBM already has a very good solution for relational databases, DB2, and they would rather put a front end to it than to redo everything in XML. And same thing with every darn database vendor out there. The only people who are likely to do this are the upstarts, who don't have any customers to begin with, and are hoping that they'll get new customers just because they put everything in XML. But there are good, honest to goodness, important research questions here as to what is the right way to do path queries optimally on XML databases. What does it mean to have statistics on XML databases? So for example, relational databases, you have things like cardinalities, selection, I mean, the selectivity statistics and so on and so forth. What are the right ones to remember for an XML database if it is in native XML? Okay. In relational databases, you, for example, have things like do selections, what do? You push selections as low down as possible. That means you first do the selections and then start doing joins. These are some of these normal, obvious thumb rules that everybody has in relational databases. What are those sorts of heuristics as well as strategies, optimization strategies for XML databases? So there are two different kinds of questions, and there are a bunch of people doing this, bunch of people doing this, and so that takes care of 75% of the, not, you know, a large percent of the SIGMOD paper for the last several years. Okay. I won't talk too much about this, but I'll talk a little bit about this. I don't know why this came here. So that's, as I said, on the internet, nobody needs to know that you are RDBMS. So you can actually act like you've always been an XML database by just changing your facade. Okay. The interesting questions that you have in doing this sort of support is what? So basically, you have something like this, right? So you have your relational database here, and you put a front end, okay? And this front end takes X query and gives XML out. So as far as outsiders are concerned, you are an XML database. Every once in a while, you'll choke on an X query, and they'll know that you are not an XML database, if you choke. Okay, as long as you don't choke, you're okay. So the question is, how do I make sure that I can take an X query, convert it into the right set of SQL queries, send it to my database, okay? And then when the database gives my relation, the tuples back, how do I very quickly tag them? Because tuples don't by themselves make any sense. You know, the X query might have a return expression which explains how to send these relations back, these tuples back with, you know, arbitrary tagging and attribute values, etc. Okay, so you quickly convert this into XML here and send it out. So there is a query conversion and there is tagging. And of course, for the users to be able to even write XQuery queries, they need to know what is it that you export. So presumably the first order of business is this thing exports an XML what? Schema. It should export an XML schema of the database. For somebody to ask questions about your database, they need to know your schema, right? Okay. So you have a relational schema, now you write an XML schema, which is sort of equivalent in your view to what you can support. And then you advertise that. And people write X queries, taking that as the schema input, and then, you know, you convert that into SQL, come back. Okay? A lot of work is being done this way right now. Okay? In such that you can actually, this has the advantage that this becomes the lingua franca, and you know how many people actually speak French as lingua franca. You know, as long as you act as if you do, then you can always convert it into your native language, answer the queries, put it back into something that looks like the standard, and send it up. Okay. The interesting issues are need to convert relational data into XML, which is tagging. You need to quickly put tags. Now, it's easy. In my way of thinking, it's sort of an obvious thing. You know, you just put some tags. But obviously, there are fast ways of doing it and the slow ways of doing it. Okay. And there are lots and lots of papers, not lots, at least like 5-6 papers, which talk about how to tag high throughput top relational data and send out XML data without blinking. Okay, do it as fast as you can. Okay, there are lazy ways, there are eager ways, all that sorts of fun stuff. But you can at least know a naive way of doing it very quickly. The other one is somewhat more interesting as a question, which is you need to convert XQuery queries into equivalent SQL queries. One of the interesting things is there may not be a one-to-one correspondence. There may not be a one-to-one correspondence between a single XQuery query and a single SQL query. It may at least be that an XQuery would be a union of SQL queries. Okay. And furthermore, as I said, for example, XQuery supports schema querying. It basically has no differentiation between tags and the data. So the XQuery expressions can combine both tag information and the data information. Okay, saying things such as, for all the documents which have two writer, I mean, for all the book elements which have two writer elements in them, do the following. I don't really care what the writers are actually, what are the names of the writers, but the fact that it has two writers, that matters. Okay, and so it would be interesting how to convert this into an equivalent SQL query. There are interesting papers right up in another too. This, I believe, I could be wrong, but some of this stuff is discussed in much more depth in Yichen's class on web and what is it called now? Web and data, right? With data on the web. Okay, so she winds up being much more. In fact, she has done a lot of interesting work on these sorts of issues of how to support X queries on relational databases, and also I think at least some work on probably how to do native XML papers. Okay. So that's basically the connection between XML, and this is basically your XML middleware for databases. Okay, don't look beyond that. So what I want to do now is, since we are in the business of talking about standards and syntax today, I want to bring up a couple more standards. There's many, many standards and, you know, and their syntax in general. But there is this whole issue of semantic web. How many of you have heard the word or the phrase semantic web? Okay. So I want to at least connect it up to what we are discussing. Okay. I can't do a very deep job because I'm hobbled by the fact that there's not yet deep stuff in semantic web right now as we speak. But there are some interesting things that are going on where people, I mean, where the practice is outstripping the theory. Okay. So quickly, what I would try to do is to give you some quick motivation as to what it is that people in semantic web are trying to do. I'll probably only look at the least common denominator, because the most ambitious ones are out of this world. Okay, everything can be done according to them. But we'll at least look at what is the least common denominator where semantic web dream or holy grail or objective is different from anything we have seen till now, such as XML. And then talk about how they are trying to do it. Okay, and then end at how people who don't care about semantic web methods but do care about semantic web's goals are short-circuiting the methods and finding other ways to reach the same goal. Okay, those are your folks, enemies, and stuff. Okay, so that's what I'll try to do. Okay, so this is some of this I already mentioned as we were doing XML, to actually mention to you that XML does not capture semantics. You remember that Chinese thing, except I have a version which is not even Chinese. It is some, what is it, Zap Dingbat. So nobody will read that language at least. But essentially, XML is not semantics. XML is just tags. And the tags have, you know, different people have different meanings attached to those tags. So what we are right now, according to the semantic web proponents, are we have a syntactic web. Because obviously the opposite of semantics is syntactic. And what you can do in syntactic web is all these things that you can do, that you know you can do. I won't go through this. You can read this and you know that you can do them. I don't have to convince you that you can do them. Basically a place where computers do the presentation and people do the linking and interpreting. You know, you are shown the place. So again, the classic way is you ask what's the time, and they'll show you a place where you could find what the time is. Okay, so which is just you go there, you'll find out. As again, as here is the time. So a way of looking at it is that, you know, computers are doing the easy part and we are doing the hard part. But there is another way of looking at it, which is this easy part is the part that we would go up the wall trying to do it. It's just mind-numbingly, you know, repetitive. Whereas this hard part, for a few cases, maybe we don't mind doing. That's part of the reason why, you know, web seems to be. Syntactic web seems to be doing quite well, despite the fact that everybody complains that it's just syntactic web. Okay. However, It's possible that you could dream and say, look, you know, why not get the computers to do more of the hard work? You know, why can't they do more of the interpretation and answering the question directly? Okay. And here is actually a single example. These are, by the way, a slide that I took from somebody. I put down the name, and I actually put a link to it too. Let me just show you this. If you have to keep track of readings list, and I'm adding to readings list. So, for example, on the semantic web, this is the Scientific American article, which we'll talk about a little bit in passing. This is the Dream Manifesto, one of the highly cited papers. And people read the Dream and assume that it's been done already. I have read enough papers by people outside of computer science and some by people inside computer science who said problem X is now solved because it reduces to semantic web. You see, and semantic web isn't solved. In fact, nobody is even really seriously working on it, as far as I can tell. There's a lot of work going on, but I'm not sure that they're working on it seriously. Okay, but it's worth knowing what's the dream and what's the reality. And finding what's the current reality is pretty darn hard. I will do my best today, but you know, you should keep your eyes open. And this is a course on semantic web, just on semantic web, okay, with like about 6 lectures or something on it. And I'm picking a couple of them from there and discussing this today, okay. You'll notice that the course that we're doing here is probably a union of 5 or 6 different courses, which basically should make you feel really good because you're getting 5 courses in one. And then this one is W3C standards page for semantic web standards. And then this is folksonomies, which we'll talk about towards the end. But there are all those links there, so you should look at some of this reading material. Okay, so here is this guy's example to convince you that syntactic web doesn't do everything else, everything that you want to do. Which is apparently, he has this following question: find images of Peter Bader Schneider, Frank von Hamelin, and Alan Rector. And these are some of the folks in Semantic Web. Semantic Web folks have their own conference now. It's called International Semantic Web Conference. And it has like 500 people attending every year. So it's a big, big community. I don't know where it's going, but you know, it's a big community. And these are some of the interesting people there. And so apparently they wanted to see their own page images. And so this guy is Peter Bader Schneider. And then that is the Frank von Hamelin. And this is not the picture of Alan Rector. What they want to show you is, why did you get this from Google Images? You got it because the tag for it says Reverend Alan M. Gates, Associate Rector of the Church of. And so there is an Alan, there is a rector, and so it's highly ranked. Okay? Now, what's interesting, of course, is that this example shows you, I'm actually going to argue in a different way. For the whole course, I've been saying that you guys should stop being so darn happy about Google, okay? Today, I would start arguing opposite because I should not agree with my lecture, okay? So that you would look at the other side, which is, you know, one way of looking at this is, look, what a, you know, silly thing we're trying to do where, you know, if you just go by images, the Google-based, text-based search, you would get these kinds of nonsensical answers. But the other interesting point is that it actually takes a reasonable amount of work to come up with an example like this. Most examples are probably pretty darn close to what you're looking for, okay, which is kind of depressing, which means that we are not really expecting too much from web to begin with. So anyway, so these guys then want to say that this is the real Alan Rector, and this is what should have been given by Google. And they're unhappy about Google giving the other guy, and so that is an example of semantic web, syntactic web not being able to do something that could be done, that should be possible to do. And I think here are more interesting questions that you actually cannot answer with syntactic web. So which is, find information about animals that use sonar but are not either bats or dolphins. Okay. I'm sure most of you don't even understand. I didn't understand what the heck they're asking, you know, and I'm not even Google. I'm a full-fledged human being. And yet, you know, this is an interesting question. And somebody who is trying to complete, a term paper on animals for their home, you know, for their school, as my son is, might be very interested in this kind of pointed question. Okay, I mean, I might say that you should do your homework. You shouldn't depend on web to answer your questions. But, you know, it's a reasonable question to ask. And, you know, you can ask yourself, can you answer these kinds of questions? Okay. Locating information in data repositories. You know, this is something that we talked a lot about, which is, don't tell me where the information is. Find it, put it together, give me the answer. Okay, that's something that we've been talking a lot about. We do it ourselves right now. We provide that linkage between databases. All Google would do is, here are all the things that, you know, might be of interest to you. Okay. And then there is this stuff about web services, which we might get to later on. And then at least these two. I would not look at these because we haven't talked about these views, but at least these two make sense. These are things that should be possible to do on syntactic web. I mean, on web, but are not possible in syntactic web. Okay, so the question is, what's the problem? What is the problem? The web page is just text, and the web search engines are not doing natural language processing, and they want to still get the same advantages that, you know, entities which do full natural language processing can get out of them. Okay, that's the usual problem. And so there is markup, but the markup is essentially rendering and also hypertext, hyperlinks to other thingies. Okay, this whole system works as long as you are in the middle. So you are the mediator, really, between the web pages. And you mediate for the problems that you are interested in between the web pages. Okay. And so semantic content is accessible to these mediators, the humans, because they can understand the language, but not to the computer. Okay. And so, you know, from that particular page, if you just de-HTMLize everything, this is the text on it. And, you know, these are the next set of slides you've seen in a different version previously. So that text makes some sense to you for your computer. It looks like this. And XML tagging would make it look as if there is some, again, to you, it makes it look as if there is some connection to reality. But these may not mean anything to your program either. In fact, one of the most important philosophical issues is meaning comes from, I mean, this is the only philosophy I'll ever tell you. Meaning comes not from the entity itself, but how that entity is related to other entities. Okay? And to the extent we think there is meaning to introduction, it's because we have humongous amount of background knowledge about relations between all other things, and some of which at least are related to this word called introduction. And so we have given meaning to it because we have all this background knowledge. Where is the background knowledge for this page? There's no background knowledge other than the web page that's there. Okay. So the question then is that you want to add semantics. And what we mean by adding semantics really is you want to add the background theory that you take for granted. Now, of course, if each web page is given a normal four-year-old's brain along with the web page as the background knowledge, then you're done. But we don't know how to do that. That's AI complete problem. Okay, we don't yet know how to do that. Okay, so the question is, can we write down at least some background knowledge which can help you do some connections between the terms that are appearing on the document. Now, this background knowledge, the name that's given to it, you know, how many of you have done 471 intro to AI? Okay. So the word background knowledge is there. It's basically, it's just a bunch of logical axioms. Okay. Now, that's one way of, it could be represented as a logical axioms, it could be represented as some Bayesian networks or whatever, but it's background knowledge on top of which in conjunction with the specific facts that you have in the web page might allow you to derive some interesting inferences. Okay? So you want to be able to support inferences on these pages. That's what you're trying to do. And so when they say add semantics, what they're saying is for each page, somehow there should be a quick way of figuring out what's the background knowledge that's required to understand this page, to support some reasonable inference. Now, that's important to understand, because skipping over semantic web history, which you can read And that's how the web page, the front page of Scientific American article looks. And there's a lot of hype there. We'll get through all this hype. And what we want to get to is this part, which is really you need some ways of writing background knowledge about pages. Okay, the what's in the pages. And so XML are tags. Now you don't know how the tags are related to anything else that you know. Are to each other. There are no relations. All you have are, so if you know the logic terminology, you have facts but no rules. You have no quantified background rules. Facts by themselves don't let you do anything. If you know deductive database terminology, what you have in a web page comes close to EDB, extensional database. And the interesting part of deductive databases is there is a IDB, which is intentional database, which is a bunch of rules which when applied to these base facts will allow you to derive new facts. You may give a bunch of parent relations, and there's a rule saying parent of X, Y, and parent of Y, Z implies grandparent of X, Z. That's a new rule that you have, and that sort of connects up tags in the lower level. Where do you write this? Okay, and what are the standards for writing it? So the standard that semantic web folks are pushing for is RDF, which is essentially a way of writing small. So RDF by itself is a way of writing small two-place predicates. That's it. It's two-place predicates. So it says entity one, relation one, entity, relation, entity. So the following relation holds between this entity and this entity. RDF is a bunch of such statements. RDF is a bunch of these relations. And then RDF schema then tells you how the more background theory about these entities. Okay? Now, in fact, just like the tricky part really is XML to XML schema, RDF to RDF schema, it turns out the relation is completely different. And I have to show you an example so that you'll figure this out. Okay? Let me first say that, you know, RDFS is not to RDF what XMLS is to XML. XML schema essentially tells XML document that what is the right syntax to put the document in. RDF schema really is background knowledge. If you think of RDF as the base facts, RDF schema is background knowledge. Okay? That'll become clear in a minute when I show you a couple of examples. So RDF is this, so RDF has basically, if you look, you know, it's written ultimately in XML syntax. All web standards these days are written in XML syntax, which is not too much. Say. It's like saying I'm writing it in English. Okay, anything that can be written at all can be written in XML because it doesn't put too much constraint. It says, you know, if you have a couple of tags, throw them in. Okay, even if you don't have tags, that's fine with us because text is XML too. So saying something has to be in XML is almost saying nothing. Okay, however, all these guys, all the standards that you talk about for everything web related, you know, including RDF, RDF standards, RDF schema, web service standards that we'll talk about later, they're all ultimately written with XML-ish syntax. So they have tags and stuff in between tags. Okay, but we would not look at the syntax right now. First, basically, conceptually, what you have in RDF file is things like, let's say Ian has colleague Uli. So two entities, Ian and Uli, and they have a relation has colleague in between them. That's all that particular tuple is saying, okay? And you know, you wind up saying these are resources, and the resources ultimately can be XML pointers, the universal resource descriptors. So you say this particular resource, which is given by this particular XML path expression, is related by this relation to this other particular XML resource. So that's how you'll wind up writing in syntax. Let me see if I have an example. So URIs are basically path expressions in XML. You know, that's ultimately what you want to say. Let me see if I have the syntax. I don't have the syntax here, I think. Okay, here, let me show this. Here is the syntax for some RDF element. It looks like some XML, but saying it looks like some XML doesn't mean anything because it has some tags and some things in between tags. Okay, so it ultimately looks like this, but the conceptual idea of RDFS is essentially relation. So the relations can be nested. So for example, Ian is related to Uli by has colleague relation, and Uli is related to Carol also by has colleague relation, and Uli is related to this thing, this string, by has homepage relation. Okay? And so one quick question is, what if I have three array predicates? What if I have four array predicates? If I have a predicate which has four elements, so the relation is between four things. How do I write those? I can write them. Basically, I'll make the relation itself an entity. And you would say, in that relation, the first argument is this. In that relation, the second argument is this. In that relation, the third argument is this. So it's a unnatural way of writing a three-array predicate as a series of two-array predicates. That's what, you know, RDF makes you do. But that's not even its biggest problem. You know, I mean, let's come to think of it. Ultimately, everything is written in Intel machine language. Okay? It's just a syntactic issue. And nobody really has to, if you understand that all RDF is trying to capture are statements, predicate statements, you know, you can always make up a nice front end where people can write their predicates and their arguments, and they get translated into RDF statements. That's not an issue. Okay. Okay, so the question is this. Is this meaning? You have to, I mean, we'll say this, and I'll say it very quickly because we're running out of time, but I'll want to come back to this issue again next class. I hope you understand between now and then that you need to know what is meaning. Okay, I'm not talking about the philosophical issue of what is meaning. The question of, can you write a program that, a general purpose program, that can use this information to do interesting inferences. Okay, so for example, tell me something that if you look at this, you know. I'm just making it up, I haven't even thought about it. But if you just look at this, it's a bunch of three statements I made. If you know these three statements, you should know something. Normally. These two guys are colleagues, right? Most normal ways of being colleagues, unless you have like nightlife and day life and you have two jobs, okay? Most normal cases, this guy must then be a colleague of this guy. And furthermore, Uli must also be a colleague of Ian. Colleagueness is, unlike love, is a bidirectional statement, right? So if you are their colleague, they are your colleague too. I mean, they may not actually look at you and acknowledge your presence, but they are still your colleague. All these things we know. Where is that? How can a program looking at this figure this out? Okay, so suppose my classic 471 example is the following. Some of you have heard this, but and you know, I'll say it anyway, but those of you who didn't hear it. It's a simple question, which is the explorer Magellan went around the world three times. And one of those trips he died. Which one did he die? Those of you who are still thinking about the answer have bigger problems than this class. Okay? Okay. I checked whether or not my son is doing okay in his brain situation by asking him this question. And I think he gave a very funny answer. I forgot what it is. But anyway, that's the classic case of background knowledge. That's the classic case of background knowledge. Where in the sentence that I just, the little passage I told you, is the fact that if you go around three times in the world and you do die, then, you know, you must have died in the last I'm hoping that all of us agree that he died in the last one. In fact, by the way, he died during the last trip. So he actually did part of his trip as a dead man. You know, there's a whole history of Magellan. But normally, you do not consider the possibility that he died on the second trip and then they took him around one more time, you know, just because they were nice to him. Okay? You just think background knowledge-wise this not make sense. This doesn't make sense. Where is his background knowledge? Where are you going to write it? You get it because we kept telling you, I mean, not you, not me, but your parents kept telling you, or you looked around the world and got all this background knowledge by the time you were about 4 or 5. And in particular domains, you may know background knowledge as soon as you get in that domain. No, for your computer, you have to write it somewhere. Okay? So, to actually say such things, so for example, these two together means this is a colleague of this, it's a statement on has-colleague relation. For all XYZ, has colleague XY and has colleague YZ implies has colleague XZ. And for all XY, has colleague XY implies has colleague YX. There should be a place where you write this. And this better not be written for every darned web page. Such a pain. Okay? So this is background knowledge that we all sort of count on. So one idea would be to put this in schema information. Call this schema. This is just the background knowledge that you have to understand this page. And multiple pages might be using the same background knowledge, so all of them just put a link to it. That's what your RDF schema is going to tell you. So it's not really what XML schema is to XML. It's completely different. It's background knowledge. You change the background knowledge, you change the meaning. You can call these things anything you want. The English name is just so that you guys can feel as if there is a meaning to it. Your computer program will have a meaning to it only in terms of how this thing is related to other things. Okay? So we want to support RDF, this is RDF syntax. So you want to support RDF schema, which in essence, in the best of all cases, it should be a large, you know, some sort of a knowledge representation language which allows you to write general knowledge that you have about the world or that is pertaining to this particular web page. Okay? And that's what RDF schema tries to do. And here is this picture you should understand. You know, it only a piece of it is available right now. Once I open this, that picture you should have in your mind to understand the difference between RDF and RDF schema. Okay? So here is an RDF triple. Discrete mathematics is taught by David Billington. You read this and you all of a sudden know a whole bunch of things. So you, for example, know that David Billington is probably not a chair like this. I didn't say it, but you know it already because you think people teaching courses are normally animate. They may not look like that, they may look bored, but they're animate objects. Okay? And discrete mathematics is sort of a course. It's not a table. Okay? Where did I say this? As soon as you read this, your brain goes into overdrive and figuring out all these inferences. Your computer doesn't. Unless all your program is supposed to do is to hardwire just this relation into it. Okay? To make any sense of this, you need to put some background knowledge. That's your RDF schema. In this particular case, this is a fragment of knowledge which has stuff like this. For example, David Billington is an associate professor, apparently. Associate professor is a subclass of academic staff members. Academic staff member is a subclass of staff members. Okay, and then is taught by is a relation which should have two arguments. And this argument better be a thing of type course. And this argument better be a type of academic staff member. Not just a human being. We have slightly higher standards now. Okay, must be an academic staff member. And not even a person who sits at the reception, only academic staff member. Now, this does not yet capture all the things you know about this one sentence. But this captures a heck of a lot more than just that. The more you have here, the more useful inferences you can make. Okay, this is Knowledge Representation 101. If you can write the background knowledge, you can do inferences using some nice inference languages. Now the problem, of course, is most inferences in interesting inference languages are what? where do you talk about inferences in AI courses? And AI courses are not interested in any problem that is at least, I mean, any problem that's less than NP complete. That is just details. We are not interested in anything that can be solved too easily. Okay. Most interesting inference algorithms and interesting languages, you know, they start NP complete and go higher. You know, first order predicate logic. If you can write stuff in first order predicate logic and you want to see whether a theorem follows from it, a fact follows from it, what's the complexity of it? It's semi-decidable. That means if there is an answer, the computer will come back before the universe dies. If there's no answer, it may not come back even before the universe dies. It just doesn't, it's a halting problem. Okay, so that's the kind of inference difficulty we are talking about. So how do you reduce the complexity of inference? You ask simpler questions. First order predicate calculus, inference is what? Semi-decidable. If all your knowledge is written up in propositional logic, what's the inference complexity there? Boolean logic. Essentially, inference is co-NP complete in Boolean logic. Model checking is NP complete, inference is co-NP complete. So I can always reduce how much time it takes to think by letting me think only, I mean, only think about small things. Don't think about too expressive a thing. Think about things that can be written in this restricted language. So part of what, so there is issue of RDF and RDFS. So this is base knowledge, this is background knowledge. Now at that level it looks like this is just an AI problem. But in terms of semantic web, this base knowledge is, has to be written in terms of triples. It only has to be two RE predicates. And this background knowledge also has a lot of constraints. It winds up having to be something like a description logic, which turns out to be a subclass of first order logic, for which there are reasonably efficient inference algorithms for more cases. So semantic web folks jumped on that. Description logic folks who hadn't been getting too many customers decided the way to live is to actually jump on the semantic web bandwagon. And in fact, the first thing they did as soon as they came into semantic web party is to say problems with RDBFS. They said, this is not likely to work. This is too simple. And you need at least what we can offer you. So RDBFS is weak. Of course it's weak. In fact, first order logic is weak. That's why they have second order logic, third order logic, second order logic, model logic, and so on. So RDFS is weak, and so we now have something called OWL, which is much closer to a true description logic, which is still less expressive than first order logic. And OWL is a step forward for semantic. Okay? So those are the standards of semantic web, and I'm going to just show you something but not talk about it, just so that you will think about it at home. Suppose I figure out my standards, and I, you know, you agree that RDF looks good, RDFS looks good, and you have taken 471. You already have an, you know, ideal theorem prover lying around, or a Bayesian inference engine lying around, so you're ready to hit the, you know, ground running. All you need is somebody who writes for each page out there a bunch of RDF statements, and somebody else who writes a bunch of nice RDF schemas. Then you can put your semi-decidable theorem prover and we get cracking. And we can take a lot of rest because, in fact, it will take a long time to answer any question, so you can take a lot of rest between queries. The question is, who's going to write this RDF and RDFS? Not Berners-Lee, surprisingly enough. He's got his MacArthur Genius Award. He doesn't need any more money. Okay. So how do we tag the pages on the web? That's what we'll talk about next class. And that's where things like folksonomies come into place. And I am basically asking you to read a bunch of magazine articles for folksonomies because that's where the state of the art for folksonomies is. It's a bottom-up approach for dealing with tagging. Okay? Read the connections from the Wikipedia entry that I have linked to. Go there and read all about folksonomies. You'll have more fun discussing some of this stuff. Okay?